Welcome to the Game History Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Before I get to my guest, Bud Gundy, this week we have Justine's weekly recommendation. What do you have for us, Justine?
Today I'm recommending the recent Lambda Literary Award winner in gay mystery, Carved in Bone by Michael Nava.
Good choice.
A wonderful choice. It is the newest addition to his Henry Rios series, although it is set in time early in the timeline. It's set after book one and before book three. So it is back in the early 80s. The book switches from Henry Rios's story in the first person to Bill Ryan's story, which is in the third person. Bill Ryan's story starts back in 1971 when he is a 17-year-old whose father catches him giving a blowjob to his best friend, beats him rather severely, so he ends up in the hospital. And then from the hospital, the local parish priest comes and tells him his parents want nothing to do with him and he needs to leave town. So Bill Ryan goes to San Francisco and eventually their paths cross. Many of the great things about this book will provide spoilers, as do many of the books I recommend. So you need to read it to know exactly how great it is. The writing is top-notch. It is very clean. And all of the descriptions are vivid. You're really reading a first-rate, top-notch novel. I'm giving it a glowing recommendation. Eventually, Bill Ryan and Henry Rios' paths will cross about middle of the book. And in the meantime, you see Bill's journey from being this scared kid to a successful businessman. And Henry Rios is getting over his alcohol. Well, it's not, you never get over alcoholism, but he's dealing with it. He's going to AA meetings. He has a sponsor who is a high-powered entertainment lawyer down in LA who stopped in an AA meeting while he was in San Francisco, and he agreed to continue when they moved down. Henry calls him every morning about 10 minutes after he gets up. And the relationship between Henry and his sponsor is a pretty interesting one. I have to say, very few books really describe the relationships that people have with their AA sponsors. And this gives you a unique insight into how important those things are.
Well, I gotta say, I always tell you I'm going to put a book on my list. This is one I already read, and I was sucked in from chapter one. And chapter one had me in tears.
Yeah, chapter one is when the beating by the father takes place. It is really a painful one, and those things are never really resolved. He doesn't go back and see his family ever again. The young boy he was with disappears around the same time, and he doesn't turn up again, which makes it very realistic. In fiction, characters show up 10 years later, right when the action is getting good, and something triggers the entire chain of events. But that whole thing was in the background and forms the basis for a lot of the choices that the Bill Ryan character takes. So I think it's a terrific book, and it's set against the backdrop of the early AIDS crisis, when it was still called gay cancer, when people didn't really know what was causing it before they had any drugs for it. So the whole book, it's very serious. I don't know if it doesn't really have a kind of a feel good, happy kind of ending, but it has a very satisfying ending, and the writing is just so good.
It was a sad book, but I didn't end it feeling like it was a depressing book.
Yeah, no, I agree. it's not as fun as other books. There's very little fun in it, but it's interesting. It's gripping. And you really get to know these characters very well, and everybody acts as expected. You can see how from the start of where they are to what they do at the end, you can see the character developing, and everything is within their characters.
So it gets a glowing recommendation.
A glowing recommendation. Yep.
Okay, anything from Requeer Tales this week?
Well, Requeer Tales has the rights to the Benjamin Justice series, which is very well known. The first book, Simple Justice, was the first gay novel to win the Edgar Award, which is a very prestigious mystery award. This book is actually rewritten to some degree. John Morgan Wilson did a fair amount of rewriting on it, and I'm looking forward to releasing it. Christopher Rice is going to do the foreword.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty big deal.
It is. This is one of the first books that we went after, and finally, it's going to be about a year and a half after we started, we're going to get to release this.
Well, to be a queer novel that wins the Edgar Award says a lot.
Yeah, it really does.
So look forward to that one.
Yeah. So that's all I have this week.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get on with the interview with Bud.
Sounds good. Talk to you next week, Brad.
Okay, Justine. You take care. Bye. If you enjoy Gay Mystery Podcast, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. My guest today, Bud Gundy, has an impressive bio. He is a Lambda Literary Award finalist, an executive producer, and on-air host at KQED, the PBS and NPR affiliate for Northern California. In 2003, he received an Emmy Award for producing the documentary Lonely Island, Hidden Alcatraz, and he won a second Emmy Award in 2016 for directing the KQED new special, State of Surveillance. Welcome, Bud.
Thank you, Brad. Glad to be here.
Good to have you on. We're going to start talking about your television background and your transition. You started your career in 1983 as a program director, but you made an unsuccessful attempt at publishing your first novel in 1991.
That's right, yeah.
What possessed you to go from the newsroom to being a writer?
Well, I mean, I always wanted to be a writer. I grew up loving books and finding my escape in books. And so no matter what I did, I was going to try to be a writer. And I was working at the time when I finished my first manuscript, I was a reporter for a print publication here in the Bay Area. And it was a rather boring publication, to put it mildly. And so it was a real creative outlet for me to come home from work at night and write. And so I didn't really see it as a transition as much as just I always wanted to have a book published and released to the world. So
doing what you wanted to do.
Exactly.
Are there any books or a book that had strong influence on your writing?
Oh,
and how?
Like countless books have had an influence on me. I think in terms of like gay writers, I think Paul Manette, Borrowed Time and Becoming a Man, those were very, very crucial to me at an important period of my life. Randy Schultz and The Band Played On and Conduct Unbecoming were very important. I always, every couple of years, I reread two books. Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, of course, and then In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. So if I've been really working hard and I treat myself with one of those books. So, but yeah, I mean, I just don't even know how to answer that question. Every book I read and love has a massive effect on me. So,
well, none of those are breezy reads.
No, they're not. Yeah. But, you know, I enjoy breezy reads as well.
They're always good for a summer day.
Absolutely.
Now, that first novel in 1991 was nearly published by Doubleday, which declined at the final step. Tell us about your experience of working with an agent and a major publisher.
Well, it was very interesting because I got an agent for that right away, and a New York agent. And she said to me that she actually died many years ago now, but she said that I know one editor who I think might be interested in this book. So, but I'm going to send it to her and we'll see what she says. And she did. The editor at Doubleday loved it. And as I said, it went up to the committee level. I guess there were 12 people on the committee. They all had to sign off on it. Well, it didn't get out of the committee. And that experience was, I mean, it was good, but it was also an extremely negative experience in that it gave me a really distorted sense of how you can just get a New York agent and get a publisher interested. The world does not work that way. And my first outing to get almost published by Doubleday was pretty heady, but it was completely abnormal. and certainly the rest of my career proved that.
Well, considering what people go through to get published, to get an agent right away, and then to almost make it to Doubleday, I got to say you're to be commended for that, especially your first novel.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's I didn't appreciate it at the time is what I can honestly say. It just, I didn't, it's like, who did I hear? One of those one-hit wonders who said, you know, her first song was this enormous number one. I think it was, oddly enough, Debbie Boone. You Light Up My Life. And she said, you know, I had no idea. Like, I just thought this was so easy. You sing a song and you get this huge hit. And she never had another hit song. And, you know, it was starting to feel that way for me. I was never going to get published. But yes, thankfully that didn't happen.
Well, is there a reason you chose not to self-publish that novel?
You mean back in 91?
Yeah, that first one.
Well, back then it was, you know, it was called the Vanity Press, and they would publish your novel, but you had to pay them, you know, right. And I was broke, you know, so I still have it. I mean, I haven't looked at it in years. I think I have a printed copy somewhere, but yeah, I mean, it really wasn't an option back then.
Yeah, it was still pretty early before the big move towards self-publishing, I guess it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, on a lighter note, you spent the next 25 years spinning your wheels, as you say. And then in 2018, your first mystery was picked up by Bold Stroke Books.
Right.
Now, that novel, Somewhere Over Lorraine Road,
right,
scored you a Lambda Literary nomination. Tell us about that experience, your first novel.
It was pretty exciting. I mean, it was my first published novel. I had self-published two novels before then, but it was a really amazing experience. I got really great reviews for it. And, you know, coming into the market, a complete unknown, nobody had ever heard of me in terms of gay mystery. And to get the kind of reaction I did, which was extremely positive. I mean, I can't say I was like hugely a bestseller or anything, not even close, obviously, but I was very heartened by the response, most of the response that I got to it. And then to see my name on that list, it was unreal. I just could not believe that I had been nominated for a Lambda Literary Award. It was mind-blowing. So, and that came after, as you said, 25 years of spinning my wheels and writing and writing and writing and then nearly giving up and just deciding to give it this one more try. And then there I was, and I, you know, went to the awards. At that point, I did not expect to win, and I didn't, but it was still an extremely thrilling experience.
Well, there's a great quote that I love. It's, don't give up until the miracle happens.
And oh, there you go.
There you go. You did that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the long road and it was a painful road. And at the end, it was very painful. But, you know, you just keep trying. What is Thomas Edison said something like that, too. Like, I tried 10,000 times and then on the 10,001st time, it worked.
And you're an immediate out of the blue winner, like a Hollywood star. You know, they never think about the background where they were waiting tables doing side roles. They're an instant hit, they call them.
Right, right. Well, yeah, it was a pretty fun experience for sure. And I was happy to do it with this story because it was so much based on my life and the hometown where I grew up, and not my family necessarily, although pieces of my family are in there, but it was a family story, and it dealt with this older gay man and his younger self, and that younger self was more of where I was. So it was nice to have that autobiographical sheen to it.
Well, give us more of an idea of the story.
Well, it's about this older gay man. He's in his 50s and he's living in San Francisco. He's very, very successful and wealthy, unlike me. And he goes back to help his mom take care of his dad while his dad is dying of cancer. And I did a little of that as well. But and while he's back in his hometown, we find out that there was a series of murders 40 years ago when Don was a kid. And his dad was briefly suspected as the suspect. And when Don is helping to care for his dad in these final months, his dad expresses a wish to be cleared of these crimes because nobody was ever caught. And so Don thinks, well, you know, maybe I'll kick around and let's see, you know, there's been so many advances in DNA. Maybe I can go see it, like if somebody's even looked at this cold case in years. And of course, nobody has. And his first attempt to say, hey, I'll pay for the DNA tests. Well, he discovers something about these crimes that he never knew, and it kind of sets him off just to, well, let me check the next thing, and then the next thing, and then the next thing. And then eventually he gets closer and closer to solving the crime and exonerating his father. But along the way, there are some very, very unpleasant discoveries for him and memories.
Well, sounds like some twists and turns in there.
There were, yeah. I enjoyed doing that. I tried really hard to only use the clues I had already written. And sometimes I'd written them not as clues, but I just wanted it to be an organic feel. And so I would go back and just search and search and search for something that could be used as a clue. And it was dumb luck. It just worked out for me. So.
Well, I know that feeling. So
you do?
Okay. Yes, I do. I understand. No, 2018 was a big year for you. Not only did you become a published author, you became a television executive producer.
That's right.
That's still your position?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It is a lot of responsibility, but both goals of mine were, I mean, those were my two top life goals from the time I was very young. You know, when I already mentioned how I love books. And I wanted to have a book published, but also just watching the TV credits and seeing executive producer and thinking, like, that just sounded like the coolest, most amazing job I could imagine. And so I always wanted both things to happen, and they both happened for me in 2018. And I love my job, but it's not quite as glamorous and cool as I thought it would be, but I knew it wouldn't be.
You still get to see your name on those credits, though.
I do, yeah. Yeah. When a lot of times executive producers, you know, you spend a lot of time behind the scenes, so there's not actually a lot of room for credits sometimes. But it's, you know, I enjoy the position. I love working for PBS and NPR, so I'm not complaining.
Well, being an executive producer sounds like a pretty busy vocation. How do you find time doing that full-time and writing novels?
Well, it's very difficult to find time. And during the lockdown, I guess we're going to like date this interview, but it is actually, I have been working constantly. I get up at 6 a.m. I'm at my desk here, working. And I did not realize how the rhythm of the office affects how I see my day. And without that, just sitting here, I mean, it's happened again and again and again. I look up, it's 13, 14 hours later. One day, my boyfriend was away. He has a boat, so he was up at the boat. And I fired off my last email at 10 after 10. And that was after starting at 6 a.m. And wow. I worked all day long. So it was a unique set of circumstances. But there's still a lot of work to do. But for me, it's such a release to be able to write and to sink into the world of that I'm creating and the characters I'm creating, and to make this story you know, just to tie it up, make it tight, make it neat. It's not easy, but I always make the time. So sometimes, not every day, of course, but I don't think like 2 or 3 days will go by without doing something, without maybe getting a paragraph or doing a little editing or something like that.
Yeah, even if it's something you don't keep, try to get something out there.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I relate to that.
Do you? I mean, do you have a day job too?
No.
Okay.
So,
well, you're lucky.
Yes, I am. I have a husband who takes care of me.
Yep. Oh my God! Awesome.
No, it's more to it than that. But
of course,
I try to work at least 4 days a week.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There you go. But 4 days a week is a good schedule, right?
Yeah, it is a pretty good schedule, but it's not as easy as it sounds because I try to start my job start my writing at 10 a.m., but you can't sit down and say, okay, it's 10 a.m., I'm going to be creative right now.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that easy. Sometimes it works, and some days I just stare at the screen or just give up and watch cartoons. I don't know.
Yeah, I know that. Who was it? Anthony Trollope, who would come home. He was a clerk or at a bank or something. He would come home, and he would write from like 5:15 until like 8 every night. And like, bing, when the clock, he would just stop, like in mid-sentence. But I mean, you know, that's why his novels are so long.
Well, we're going to take a moment here and spin the wheel.
Oh, boy.
This is time for awkward questions authors get.
Yep.
And these are sometimes rude, sometimes just hard to answer, and sometimes they're just strange, the questions that we get. So hold on while I spin the wheel. Okay. You've done this whole TV and writing thing. When do you plan to get a real job?
You know, I think about that all the time. Like, I should have just been an accountant. I mean, it's nothing against accountants, but, you know, you can get a job anywhere. Any company needs an accountant. You know, I have this one very specific job, and I'm very fortunate because I hold it. And I would encourage everybody to, well, TV is so different now than when I started. I'm like 57 years old and I'm a dinosaur, but I think that, yeah, you know, I think about that all the time, actually. it's something I went for my heart, and thankfully it's worked for me so far.
You know, the job I think would be outstanding is managing the Macy's Day Parade, because you work on it all year and then it's done. You get that day that my job is done.
Yes,
now I'm sure the next day it's already starts all over again.
Yeah, but you don't stay up late.
Yeah,
that would be a feeling of accomplishment, wouldn't it? Just having, yeah, like you said. Well, when I worked in commercial TV, you know, the 11 o'clock news was what I worked on every night, and that was nice because you did have that feeling. Okay, that's done. Now I have to come in and do it all again tomorrow, but that show is done. So, being, you know, working on TV projects that go on for months, sometimes years, it's a whole different experience. And, you know, you don't get to choose always when you're a producer at a station, you typically don't get to choose what you work on. But I enjoy what I work on, so that's not a problem.
And writing's different because even when you're writing one story, generally there's other stories in your head. Whether they make it on paper or not, it's a whole different story.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's almost like a never-ending wheel.
It is, you know, but that's kind of what I love. I love plucking bits and pieces of, you know, I have a bunch of novels that are never going to see the light of day. But, you know, there's still like themes in there and ideas that I love to explore. And so I'll just, you know, take one from there and take one from there and put it in. And this new one I'm writing, I wrote a whole novel about it. Sort of a similar topic, in much dealing with it in a much different way, but it really, it's, you know, as long as it's good, you know, like you say, if you know, you're just kicking these ideas through your head, then, you know, I mean, that's kind of the fun of it for me, really.
But you haven't mentioned it. You have another manuscript you're working on.
Right. It's the working title is Inherit the Lightning, which I know is really close to Inherit the Wind. But but I just, it's like the perfect title. I don't know if that will end up being the title, but it is perfect. And it's a family saga. I love family dramas, and I'm from a large family. I'm the youngest of 10 kids. And so there's a lot to explore there. But this takes place over four generations, basically. It's 140 years, and there's a secret that starts way back when, and the great-grandson sort of goes on this journey of discovery where he learns all about his great-grandfather when, you know, a man who died decades before he was even born. And so it's a very, I love it, but I didn't plan to write about the great-grandfather. And then I started to, because I was forced to, and then he took over the book. So I have to work on the balance. It's been a struggle, but I love the story. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, sometimes those characters start shouting at you and there's nothing you can do.
I know. It's amazing. I mean, I was not going to give this character even a word. He was just going to be the great-grandfather in pictures. And, like, you know, now everybody loves the character, and my modern-day character is is suffering as a result.
Well, I find it interesting that in your two traditionally published and your self-published novel, that there's an interaction between younger and older people as a theme. Mm-hmm. What is it that draws you to that storyline?
Well, I think it's because I've always been drawn to older people. I've always had older friends. You know, when I moved to San Francisco, I was a young gay man, 24 years old, and I instantly became best friends with a 55-year-old woman, my landlady, sort of an Anna Madrigal kind of character. And I've just always had older friends, and I've just always liked being around older people. And I think that there's so much, it's not that they're fonts of wisdom, right? It's, you're not going to climb a mountain and then, you know, sit at their feet and listen to, you know, all the wise things they have to say. It's just that their life experience, they bring so much to that. To everything they say comes from this very rich, very deep, usually very interesting life experience. And I'm fascinated by that. So, you know, my last novel, Accidental Prophet, it was a grandmother and her grandson. This one, it's a great grandfather and his great grandson. And then some of my characters, like there's a sort of loose series that I'm writing. I don't know if I'll write any more because Accidental Prophet, I think, confused a lot of people. But some of the characters are, you know, 800, 900 years old. So it's something that I found in my life over and over and over again. And I'm just drawn to characters who feel that way as well. So
you're in Inherit the Lightning. The question about that is, my two novels are written a year behind. What I mean is my 2019 published novel takes place in 2018, and my 2020 published novel takes place in 2019. And something I'm anxious about is my next novel will likely take place during this pandemic. And I know that's going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
So you mentioned before to me that Inherit the Lightning, you plan to have some present day chapters. How are you going to work that current crisis in?
Well, you know, it has been a struggle. It was, you know, as soon as this happened, what, 2 months ago now, I realized, like, I can't, you know, I always try to set my books like just a little bit in the future, right? So what is the world going to look like? I don't know. You know, I'm just guessing that part of the story is going to be based around a temporary lockdown in New York City. That's going to be quite key to the story, I've decided. But I just happen to think that for at least the next, you know, upcoming decade or I don't know, maybe less, but For several years, we're going to be in that stage where we're very, very sensitive to this kind of thing, to the threat of a pandemic. And we've always just ignored them. And even though I'm pretty sure I had SARS at the time, but that's another story. But I just feel like there are some things that we know. I think masks are going to be part of our future for a while. And, you know, but it is hard. Like, you know, like you say, like, we don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to take a chance. I mean, everyone's saying to me, like, I belong to two writers groups. So when I say everyone, you know, it's the other writers in my groups, and They applaud me trying to do this, but they say you're taking a risk, and I am, but I just feel like you can't write a contemporary story without reference to all of this. You know, it's just, it's become such a huge part of our lives. So, well, do you have any idea what you're going to do?
No, I have none whatsoever. Yeah. How do you have a detective investigate when nobody's supposed to go anywhere and everybody's wearing masks? It's a challenge that I'm somewhat looking forward to, but I'm dumbfounded.
Yeah.
And in your case, you know, I was thinking just the other day at a cash register, those plastic dividers are not going to go away.
They aren't
suddenly going to take those down off the buses, off the cashiers. They're a permanent part of our society, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
What else is going to be different? Like you said, are masks here to stay?
I think they are. You know, I think masks are here to stay. I think temporary lockdowns are going to happen. You know, maybe there's a little cell discovered somewhere. I just, you know, like, is work from home going to be like it is now? I mean, I'm working from home just fine, which I never would have guessed. I've produced spots. I've produced a whole radio campaign from this desk, you know, so you can do it. You can do it'd be harder to direct TV, but you know, like, I do we all have to go down to the office every day? You know, I mean, and I loved going to the gym in the morning at 5 a.m. Right? Am I still going to do that? I miss the gym, you know, who knows? You know, maybe I think in your case, though, like, if you're writing about something that's happening during the pandemic, then at least you have your experience of living it. And I think you could make that a very interesting story.
Yeah. And that's exactly why I write 1 year ago. I like to put real events and that sort of thing. Okay. I like it to be present day almost.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's kind of a cheat on my part, but it works for me.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
So when do you plan to release that novel?
Oh, you know, the last one I wrote, Accidental Profit, I did sign a contract with Bold Strokes ahead of time that I would have it done by December. Now, it did force me to finish it, and there was a big, big hanging question that I hadn't resolved yet, but it forced me. I'm very good under pressure. It forced me to confront that, but I don't know if I want to do that again this time. I mean, I'm hoping that it'll be done by the end of the year. I think Bold Strokes will be interested in it because there's a lot of gay love in it, and not so much gay sex, but so I'm hoping my target is the end of the year, but it's a very, very involved book, and I'm really, I'm trying to be very careful this time. So, I mean, not that I was sloppy before, but this has become a story that I never anticipated. So it has the potential to be epic, at least in my head. So
that's what's important.
Yeah.
You know, deadlines for me are tough. My second novel I had planned to have out by October, and then I got sick, and so I ended up losing my space with my editor. And you know, one thing after another, and you know, my promises to my readers fell through, and so I'm not going to make promises in the future.
Yeah. You know, I mean, but are you working on a project now? I mean, you said you're going to start one, right?
Yeah, my second book just went on pre-order, and I am in the outlining stages of the third book, and I'm having a ball outlining. So,
do you like to do a detailed outline?
I do. I have to just to get the red herrings and the clues and make sure each suspect gets their own time. Now, what ends up at the end may totally be different, but to get out of that starting gate, I've got to have that outline.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, if that works for you, it definitely doesn't work for me. I have a vague sense of the story. I know who did it, or, you know, I know how it's going to end, but I admire people who do that kind of work ahead of time. I think it's probably helpful.
Well, see, I'm in awe of people like you that can sit there and write that kind of story with at the seat of your pants.
Well, I guess that we're all just awed by things we that other people are good at that we're not, right?
Well, you mentioned the Accidental Profit earlier, and that's available through Bold Strokes Books. That seems significantly different than Inherit the Lightning. It's Bold Strokes lists it as an interesting mix of action and adventure, paranormal, and romance. How does that experience different from writing a mystery?
Well, it was much different. And so the fans, the small group of fans I was able to collect for Somewhere Over the Rain Road. And by the way, that title, just imagine Judy Garland and some kid who misunderstands her lyrics. It was part of, I self-published a book many years ago called Elf Gift. I don't know, 10 years ago. And it's a sort of a fantasy about prophets who live on Earth and who live for hundreds of years. And I always envisioned it as a trilogy. And so my idea was, I love David Mitchell. I just discovered him like in the last 5 years. And I love the way he creates his universe. It's every book is standalone, but the story is all the same. So there's this enormous overarching story. And I thought that I could do that with my second Elf Gift novel, which is Accidental Prophet. And it wasn't successful because people just didn't know what to make of it. And I think you don't have to read Elf Gift first, but it helps. So it was a mistake on my part. Although some people really, really enjoyed it. And I remember one of the people at Bold Strokes saying, God, I love this story. I don't know if it's going to, it's so unusual. But so it's kind of a leftover urge I had. And I don't know, I'll probably get to the third one in the series at some point, but I didn't market it as a series, and I did that deliberately. But maybe that was a mistake too. I don't know.
Well, and you led into my next question. Can we expect more mysteries or non-mysteries in your future, or combination?
Yeah, I think combo is really what I'm shooting for, because the mystery of the heart of Inherit the Lightning is not a crime necessarily. It's not anything somebody would be arrested for, but it's a very deep family secret. And I always think there will be a mystery element to anything I write, because really that's what keeps people turning the pages. I mean, there are, just general fiction. A friend of mine suggested that I make this just general fiction, but I don't think I'm ready for that. I think you have to write a pretty amazing story of just general fiction to get people to want to read it,
That's my feeling. That's why I steer clear of it. Plus, I love writing mysteries anyway. So,
yeah, right. Well, and you love plotting them too, right? So,
yes, I do.
Yeah.
Well, before I let you go, I want to let people know that the books that we've talked about, they can look them up on your website, which is budgundy.com. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep.
GUNDY. And that's where I found a lot of information about your books, and it's a pretty good website.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, and I always answer emails, so if somebody sends an email, I get them from time to time. But yeah, they're pretty fun.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on, bud.
Yeah, thank you, Brad. It was a lot of fun.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.